Hello and welcome to The Medrese, a Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Europe faced with migrant crisis, Central Asia struggling with various economic challenges and entrenched dictatorships. And combination of these problems are posing serious threat to stability and security of the region. This is a grim picture outlined in the Freedom House's latest report called Nations in Transit. Today, we are joining forces with Freedom House to unlock some of these findings and discuss what these issues really means for the region going forward. To discuss the subject from Washington, I have Nate Shenkan. He is Freedom House's Project Director of Nations in Transit. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marlon.
From London, Edward Lemon, author of the Tajikistan chapter of the report, is also joining us. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man.
Bruce Panier, joining me here in the studio, who is the editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you guys. It's a long report, Nate, containing lots of information about many countries. Unfortunately, we have to focus on it is Central Asia chapter. And looking into the region, what has been the main highlights compared to the previous year? I know Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan shares the lowest score as always. I have seen at this time Tajikistan is kind of competing with these two countries. Take us through main highlights of the report, Nate.
Absolutely. So we titled the overview of the report, Europe and Eurasia, Brace for Impact. And the reason for that title is that what we felt like we saw in 2015 in Europe and in Eurasia were a lot of building trends that hadn't yet come to a head, but that in 2016 we expect are going to be hitting even harder. And obviously the Europe part is outside the bounds of our discussion today, right. But in Eurasia, this is chiefly driven by the economic crisis, which, of course, started in the summer of 2014. And you all, myself, a lot of observers of Central Asia have been saying since the oil price started dropping and since the sanctions got really serious on Russia, that there would be really dire consequences in Central Asia. And increasingly in 2015 and now in early 2016, I think that's what we're seeing. So those the economic crisis really came to dominate the agenda throughout 2015, and then the government's responses to it. And unsurprisingly, perhaps in a number of countries, in all of the countries, the responses were chiefly autocratic. You know, in Kazakhstan, you had and have had in 2015, and now have had in 2016 again, the staging of these kind of facade elections that are more about revalidating the existing government than they are about any kind of actual accountability or input from the citizenry into a policy process. In Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, in particular in Turkmenistan, you've had a huge number of government shuffles, moving people around frantically, trying to find some kind of magic formula that would unlock this crisis, which for obvious reasons isn't working. And in Tajikistan, which I hope Edward gets to talk about in more detail, that's where we had actually the second biggest score change in the entire report in all 29 countries for the really dramatic, fierce crackdown that took place.
Right, right. In Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, you know, they have always been at the bottom of the barrel. Bruce, I will come to you about this subject now. We see some backtracking in other two countries, Tajikistan and Kazakhstan, as Nate, you mentioned about Tajikistan. So, Edward, you authored the Tajikistan report. What is that backtracking about?
Well, I think 2015 was really a kind of seminal year in post-independent Tajik history. In March, you had the kind of another round of flawed parliamentary elections in which the IRPT, the Islamic Renaissance Party, which had been one of the leading independent opposition parties up until last year, lost its seat in the Supreme Assembly. And after that, you had criminal charges being lodged against its leader, Muhyiddin Kabiri, who is now in exile. And you saw the closing of the kind of offices in regions across the country, and that was used as the reason that the Ministry of Justice in August could declare that the party was going to be disbanded. And then there were attacks by the former deputy defense minister, Halim Nazarzadeh, in September, as we discussed on the Majlis. And these were blamed on the Islamic Renaissance Party, who were said to have financed it with the help of these mysterious foreign powers. And that was used as the legitimation to declare the organization a terrorist movement. So on the one hand, you've got this kind of crackdown on political parties. You've got the arrest of various lawyers that we can talk about in more detail, including, you know, the most prominent human rights lawyers who've been defending people, representatives of the IRPT, representatives of Group 24, another leading opposition movement whose leader was assassinated in Istanbul in March. And at the same time as this kind of strengthening of moves against the opposition, you also have the strengthening of Rahmon's own position. Some things that didn't end up going into the report that have happened more recently, including Rahmon obviously becoming this leader of the nation and kind of originator of peace, this new national holiday, you know, this real cult of personality emerging around Rahmon. So, you've really seen quite a dramatic shift in the human rights situation in the country last year.
And if I could say one thing about that, in terms of looking at it comparatively and how we look at the region, what happened in 2015, you know, there's been a kind of typology, perhaps, that some have applied, maybe inaccurately, but traditionally, in looking at the five Central Asian republics, of, well, Kyrgyzstan's the best performer on these democratic measures, still weak, but a better performer. Then you have Tajikistan somewhere after that, a bit of a mess, but not as repressive, not as authoritarian as Kazakhstan coming after them. And then at the very bottom, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. And I think what we're seeing from the perspective of Freedom House and Nations in Transit looking at these things year after year is we're just seeing really a clustering at the bottom of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, still a step beyond, but really Kazakhstan not being that far off now, and Tajikistan pretty rapidly approaching. So it's becoming more of a clump of four at the bottom, with Kyrgyzstan then standing considerably in a different category.
Bruce, you have done several of Freedom House reports in the past. What keeps the Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan always at the bottom of this report? Obviously, Nat and Edward, you also, you know, welcome to jump in whenever you feel relevant. Bruce, what is that? Why they are always there?
Well, you could even separate Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan a little bit. Turkmenistan started out practically from day one of independence as being an authoritarian government and clamped down on everything they could right away. Uzbekistan wasn't so far behind that, but they did kind of experiment a little bit with some of this stuff. You know, Karimov faced some serious challenges when he came into power, which Niyazov in Turkmenistan did not. So Niyazov set the table pretty much for a lot of even what's happening today as far as a model of governance. But in Uzbekistan, Karimov kind of gradually, he faced opposition from secular political parties, and so he clamped down on them, and he faced opposition, he did early on too, from Islamic parties, but he waited a little while before he moved. He got the secular parties out, and then he got the Islamic parties out. Then, you know, in Uzbekistan's case, and I wasn't writing the reports then, but in the late 90s, and especially right after 9/11, when they offered their use of bases and in Uzbekistan to the Western coalition that was going to start operations in Afghanistan, they kind of did loosen up the handle a little bit for a while. You know, parties like and movements, like Birlik, for instance, was able all of a sudden, after years of being in the shadows, was able to hold public meetings. There was a lot of Western non-governmental organizations that were active already in Uzbekistan and were registered out there. And they kind of ramped it up a little bit. I wouldn't say they had an independent media in Uzbekistan or anything like that, but they were able to report a little bit more freely. And really the watershed moment was Andijan, you know, where all of a sudden Karimov just thought that this ability to criticize the government, this ability to be active within the society and not entirely in the interests of the authorities was something that he didn't want anymore. And then he went absolutely to the Turkmen in the Turkmen direction and just stamped it out entirely.
Nate, I'm trying to understand the logic of what is happening and why it is happening. is it could be because of political stagnation of the region? I mean, can we blame some of these problems on the aging leadership or the political structure of the region?
Absolutely. I think it's helpful to think about what's happening in the economic crisis also in terms of governance. You know, this economic crisis, of course, is a convergence of at least two really important factors that are kind of that were unforeseen. So the oil price collapse coinciding with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea that produced the sanctions. So, you know, no one in early 2013 was saying, well, you know, a year and a half from now, oil prices are going to start dropping and not stop until they hit $35 or $40 a barrel. And no one was saying the U.S. and the EU are going to impose widespread and deep sanctions on the Russian economy, and Russia is going to counter with their own sanctions. These were unforeseen events. What wasn't unforeseen was that there's no buffer built in for these countries in the way that their governance had managed their economies and built up ways of responding to changes like this, or even less, more shallow changes. So even though Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan in particular, had built up enormous amounts of wealth from oil and gas revenues, they didn't really have any options and any mechanisms for responding to the crisis other than just spending down that wealth in trying to protect their currencies in particular. And they did that, you know, that's really what we were watching in the second half of 2014 and then in much of 2015. We were watching these countries burn through extraordinary amounts of money that basically just throwing away, trying to keep their currencies strong. And when that failed, because the pressures are external and structural and really they don't control them, they've more or less run out of options. Mm-hmm. Because there isn't any kind of accountability and there isn't any kind of diversification in the economy due to a structure that's built on trying to make sure that all of these profits and all of the revenues are channeled through very narrow channels that are controlled by officials close to the president, because that's how you get your wealth. And so they don't want to diversify the economy. They don't want to open it up to different kinds of ways of making money that they might not be able to control and to profit from themselves. And that's the challenge that they're at now. You know, Kazakhstan is trying, allegedly, to initiate a privatization plan to try to address this, to sell off a large amount of state assets. It's unclear whether that will work. It's unclear whether there's really much interest right now, given the environment for foreign investors and the legitimate fears that foreign investors have that at better times, if those those items, those assets become profitable, that they could be expropriated by the government. Or in the case of Turkmenistan, where they were trying to seek for a long time foreign investors in order to develop gas fields and to create the Tapi pipeline, and essentially have had to say that there aren't the foreign investors. Again, for very similar reasons, that until the governance starts looking different, until investors start feeling like there's enough rule of law that they're not vulnerable to being expropriated at any moment in time, they're going to have a really hard time getting out of this hole.
Mm. We are talking here what to blame, what's behind these problems that are indicated in your report. Edward, Nate mentioned about the, in case of Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, that the issue of bribery, corruption, and the authorities' efforts to keep that money in their control. But in Tajikistan, for example, there is not lots of money to talk about corruption. So what was that which is taking Tajikistan back?
I think there is widespread corruption in Tajikistan, and a lot of that money, you know, billions and billions of dollars, is being taken offshore to places like the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands, the Isle of Man. And you have the situation in which public companies that are supposed to pay tax and are supposed to serve the interests of the people and go into the state budgets are actually, the money's being siphoned off and taken to, yeah, the bank accounts that are controlled by members of the Rahman family. And the elite. So I think there is widespread corruption. It's not on the same scale as in some of the other countries of the region, because Tajikistan remains the poorest country in the region. In terms of the reasons if I understood your question correctly, as to why
it
was such a kind of backstep in Tajikistan last year. I think it's difficult for as an outsider to really say what's going on inside the Tajik government. I think it's quite chaotic. I think there are a number of rivalries between different individuals, different kind of interest groups within the government. And I don't think it's always Rahman has total control over what his different ministers are saying and what they're doing. Like the campaign against the IRPT, it's difficult to say whether that was kind of a long-term plan to marginalize and ban the party or if it was kind of opportunism. So yeah, it seems like what Tajikistan is doing is damaging its name in the international community.
That's for sure.
But they're managing to get away with it. You know, they're the statements of the EU and the US and other kind of international organizations, or intergovernmental organizations on the human rights crackdown have been relatively weak. And there's a continued support of security services, continued military aid, continued support from the IMF despite the corruption. So seemingly Tajik officials are realizing that they can get away with doing what they are.
Bruce, about what's happening, why it's happening in Tajikistan. Is it what you were reading is like what Edward was saying?
Well, absolutely. I would agree with that. I would say that, you know, really across the whole region, let's start out with the fact that I think all the leaders of these countries, certainly maybe with the exclusion of Kyrgyzstan, understand that they're probably not genuinely popular among their people. And they're all going into a hard time. And so this is one of those times where they've always been very thin-skinned when it comes to criticism of their policies. And this is a bad time for that kind of character, that kind of reaction toward criticism, because there's certainly a lot of criticism that could be leveled at them. They just don't want to hear it. They're afraid that it'll damage certainly their reputations, but more so their hold on power. And so I think, you know, even in the worst countries that you mentioned, like Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, we've really seen them harden policies, and that's happened in Tajikistan, and it's happened in Kazakhstan, and to some extent it's happened in Kyrgyzstan too, where they're trying to get root out government critics so that the sole narrative of what's happening with the country, its future, its economy is in the hands of the authorities, and no one else is allowed to speak about that. And I think that was a big problem in Tajikistan, where they realized the Islamic Renaissance Party had their own agenda, their own ideas, and they were obviously going to criticize government moves because there was no way the government could head off the bad economic times that were coming. So the simplest solution was to just get rid of them.
Right. Here, some technical question, Nate. You know, we see this scores, 6.3, 4.4 or something. How you come up with those numbers? Based on what? What's the criteria for that?
So Nations in Transit is a qualitative survey. So you have seven different indicators for the listeners. National democratic governance, electoral process, civil society, independent media, local democratic governance, judicial framework and independence, and corruption. So seven different indicators, each with a scale from 1 to 7, 1 being the best, 7 being the worst, and you can move by quarter point increments within that. So the it's a qualitative indicator. It's based first on the researcher, the Country Report author's judgment. They do the first rating. Then Freedom House, along with its advisors, does a review process of that rating, and the scores are the responsibility of Freedom House. So it is qualitative. It's we're essentially making a judgment about where we see governance falling, both on the scale of 1 to 7, and in a sense, we try to make it something that is comparable. You know, between the 29 countries. We want it to be something where there's a kind of consistent evaluation. And I should add, I mean, there's a large number of questions that go into each of those seven categories. It's not simply your own definition of each of these categories. There are a large number of questions and sub-questions that fall under these by which you make that scoring.
Was there any reaction by let's talk about Central Asia, to the findings of your report so far?
I've not yet seen one in Central Asia specifically. You know, we'll see. Today's the second day. So, still waiting. I suppose if anybody was to react, it would be Tajikistan. And if I could say one more thing about that, about the point I was making earlier about where the money will come from in this crisis, which I think is the big one of the big questions in 2016 for everybody in the region. You know, for Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, they're trying to find outside investors or other sources, like I said. I think Tajikistan is going to have a very hard time when it comes down to getting the large support that they need, not just kind of temporary stuff, but I think Tajikistan is going to need a bailout, a proper, you know, multi-billion dollar bailout from either an international financial institution or from China or Russia. And the appetite, I think, at the IMF for a really large operation like that is, I would think, quite low right now, unless there are really strict conditions on it that they think Tajikistan will actually meet, because the IMF has had a bunch of really bad experiences in Tajikistan of essentially bailing out banks and having that money be stolen. And I don't know that Russia wants to do it either. Russia, of course, is going through its own problems. It's having a very hard time meeting its, has essentially backed away from its commitments in Kyrgyzstan that it had made before the crisis in order to incentivize Kyrgyzstan to join the Eurasian Economic Union. And now has basically said, we can't meet those obligations, especially on the hydropower plants and probably on Gazprom's side in terms of overhauling the Kyrgyz gas system. So it leaves China. And, you know, China is obviously a tough one to study and a tough one to scrutinize the decision making about this kind of thing. But I'm not sure that China either sees how important is it for China to have better access in Tajikistan or to have Tajikistan survive a financial crisis if China feels that that money is going to be not, they're not going to see a return on that investment. I'm not sure that they care enough either. So I think Tajikistan's in a really tough place unless some stuff changes.
You put just the bombastic point there. I'm just trying to think another blog post that I read last week that was written by the country director of Asia Development Bank to Tajikistan. He or she was complaining that the Tajikistan was given $1 billion loan in 2015, and the outcome was disappointing. So even the Eurasian Development Bank is talking in the same line what you predict, Nate, about the IMF. So what is waiting for Tajikistan, Edward?
No, I mean, I agree with what Nate said. I think that the country and economy will need a bailout, and I struggle to see who will be offering the cash, especially, as Nate said, given the experiences of the IMF and effectively having their money taken and given in uncollateralized loans to businesses linked to the elite. So, yeah, I think, you know, Tajikistan being the most remittance migration-dependent country in the world, you know, it's really, really feeling the effect of the downturn in the Russian economy and, you know, the drop in remittances has been more severe than most of the international financial institutions were predicting. So,
and if I could say one thing about that, and we may be passing through this time, but it is notable that for everyone, like all of you who've been following this since it started in summer 2014, the international institutions, and I think for good reason, because they have to make data-based predictions, but many of the international institutions have been too optimistic throughout. You know, World Bank projections, if you look at the World Bank projections and you go back and look at the ones they were making at the beginning and as the crisis developed, they're consistently more optimistic than what's actually happened. And I think that, you know, that may be changing because the oil prices are no longer dropping. They're sort of steady at a very low level. So maybe it's starting to line up with what their predictions are. But it's something worth keeping in mind, especially in relation to the statistics that are produced by the statistical agencies in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, where those statistics really have reached a point where they are probably not reliable for some of the really headline economic factors.
Nate, let me put an opposite point. that might reflect a political position of some of the those regional countries. If President Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan or the Rahman of Tajikistan would be sitting with us today and doing this podcast, they might say, guys, you don't know what you are talking about. These numbers are made up. You never been to Tajikistan or Turkmenistan to do this research. So what would be your answer to that kind of question? We obviously, we have seen this type of reaction in the past by some of those Central Asian countries.
Sure. I mean, I would just say that it's impossible. I mean, you know, Turkmenistan's economy is based on selling gas. Gas prices have dropped by whatever it is, you know, 80%. And to say that your economy is going to continue to grow at a steady between 6 to 8% every single year, you know, no matter what the gas price is absurd. I mean, same thing with Uzbekistan. You know, they also are an energy exporter. They're also remittance dependent. Their remittances have dropped somewhere around, you know, 40 to 50%, maybe a little more year on year. And they've also been dealing with not selling as much gas for not as much money. And to say, yeah, we've got the exact same growth as we've had for essentially the last, whatever it is, 7 or 8 years, you know, that it's pretty much the exact same figure, you know, it's comical. It just doesn't make any sense.
Thank you. Thank you, Nate. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will discuss what does this score predicts about the future of the region. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Today we are discussing findings of Freedom House's recent report called Nations in Transit in Central Asia, and what does those findings indicate about the future of the region. Discussing the subject with me is from Washington, and Nate Schenken. He is Freedom House's Project Director of Nations in Transit. From London, Edward Lemon, who is the author of Tajikistan chapter of the report, and here in the studio, Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Nate, again, I am coming back to you. Now, you have this report, and it does provide lots of relevant information, no doubt about objectivity of its assessments of today's situation and potential developments in the future. So what does it say about the future of the region going forward?
Well, I think the first thing, of course, is the impact of the crisis in 2016, as we've been discussing. How well do the governments weather a very deep economic downturn? That is the issue in 2016. I think that will continue to be the issue in 2017, because looking at the projections, Russia is really only on the edge of returning to growth probably in 2017 at best. And that means that the mainstay of the regional economy really will stay at a very low level. And the remittance economy won't come surging back. It's not going to come rushing back the way it did somewhat after the financial crisis, because as you all remember, there was a steep downturn in Russia following the global financial crisis, and that did have an impact on migrants in 2008, 2009, and there was a downturn, but then Russia really was able to return to some pretty rapid growth at a time of high oil prices in this period of 2011 to 2013. It doesn't look like that's going to happen now. And it looks like Russia will be at a low level of growth, not only this year when they'll be in recession, but next year, and probably even for a year or 2 years after that. There's no big wave coming through, and people don't project the oil prices to go spiking back up. So there's no big wave coming through that's going to lift up the economies again of Russia, as well as Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan to some degree. And there's also a problem that Russia's economy itself is these lost years of growth and these lost years of investment, especially as this is where the sanctions come in. The lost year of investment due to sanctions in the oil industry and in development of new oil and gas fields means that Russia's overall growth trajectory for years, maybe even for decades, and chain. And that really is a major, I do think this could be a pivotal couple of years as a result for this region, where a very Russia-centered model of growth and trade, a Russia and energy-centered model of growth and trade, does not apply anymore. And these countries are forced to restructure their economies, and it's unclear how they're going to do that. But the assumptions that guided these economies, both the successful ones and the unsuccessful ones, for roughly 15 years, those assumptions are really breaking down.
Yes, the picture is very, very grim. And I was just doing a report on IMF's forecast about 2016 and 17. And even there, the forecast, not only about the 2016, but also 2017, is grim compared to the previous years. I'm just trying to put a positive picture on all this. If there is anything can influence positive change in all this grim picture, what that thing would be, Bruce Panier?
Well, you know, I've spoken in the past about a little bit of creativity and policy making. There, you know, Nate said it quite well that you know, they have these systems that they've developed, and they seem to be depending on the fact that they can keep these systems in place and ride this out until something changes for the better. And to some extent, that's been working for them for a number of years now. You know, things are clearly going to change, and we've had not just our guests today, but our guests in previous Medjlis sessions have also said that you know, remittances probably won't come back, and the price of oil won't come back to record highs. And you know, so in the absence of that, what is going to be the policy? And I really don't know that they can affect any change for the better, given what they got for government officials and heads of state at the moment. Their biggest salvation, and I'm talking about the leaders of the countries, is that there's this general perception on the part of the population throughout Central Asia that any change is going to be bad, which is why these guys are able to stay in power as they are, because people are just afraid that whoever comes after them is going to be even worse. And so that keeps people from going out in the street and protesting or demanding overthrow of the government or anything like that. But I just can't see how, with the cards they got, I can't see how they can possibly improve living standards, any of those things across the board. And sadly, I think there'll be absolutely no hope of them loosening up the political system and allowing, you know, opposition parties to register and things like that. That, you know, that would be a long-term view of how to maybe improve the country. And I just can't see that they would be willing to risk that at this point. So we're stuck in this for, you know, probably half a decade.
Let me try once more. And this time, Nate or Edward, you might wish to take this question. We are talking about the solution or potential or possible solution. Can this paper provide basis for cooperation between international organizations and relevant states to come clean from this prediction? Is there any chances that this to happen? I'm trying to think about what Macedonia has just did in terms of releasing lots of political prisoners. It has been one of the countries lashed out in Europe chapter of your report, Nate. Obviously, I don't know if there is any link between the action of Macedonian authorities and your report, but this is what has happened. So do you see these kind of things happening in Central Asia, and could that provide a solution for going forward?
Well, I'll approach it from the perspective of nations in transit as a long-term survey that's been going on since 1995 of transition across a very large region, not only in Central Asia. And there are countries within this region, especially, of course, in Central Europe and in the Baltics, that have transformed from where they were 25 years ago. And it's instructive, I think, for folks who focus on Central Asia, like I have for a while, but it's instructive then to sit down and read what these countries did and look at the kinds of reforms that they have done and that they're still doing. And it really throws into stark relief things that haven't been done and aren't being done in Central Asia. And I'm talking about things like reforming police structures, reforming ministries of interior, reforming judicial systems, overhauling prosecutors' offices. Of course, having free and fair elections matters. Having actual opposition parties, allowing actual opposition parties to present different policy alternatives and to compete in the space of ideas, so that governments have to develop actual policies that address policy problems and aren't simply window dressing for a facade election. There's a lot to do. It's very difficult. It's very complex. It takes a long time, but it's not a mystery, you know? Much of this, and many of these things are proposals in various ways that have been brought forward in Central Asian governments and in Central Asian states for a couple of decades also, and for various reasons, they haven't been taken up or pushed forward, even in Kyrgyzstan. So if you look at Kyrgyzstan as the reformer, typically cast as the reformer in the region, and it's true that Kyrgyzstan is a step ahead and in a different category from these other governments, other states, even Kyrgyzstan, since the revolution in 2010, has not executed judicial reform. They simply haven't done it. And this is one of the key elements of any kind of transition to a rule of law state, is to create an accountable, independent, trusted, objective judiciary. It's a very hard thing. It takes a very long time and a lot of money and a lot of work, but everybody knows it's something you've got to do. Right. And if you don't do it, you really don't create a rule of law state.
Right. Final point, Edward. We have to wrap up our discussion. Best possible scenario for Central Asian countries in terms of solutions. What can they do, or anyone can do, to change the trend?
Sure. Well, I think reform ultimately has to come from within the countries themselves, I guess, within the societies. I guess I share Bruce's skepticism that unfortunately I think things will probably get a lot worse before they get any better, both economically and in terms of political rights, particularly in Tajikistan. But I think the social media, you know, is an interesting place where, you know, we are seeing young people in particular, you know, more freely discussing political and social injustices and, you know, other issues and voicing their opinions on them. You know, there is a debate going on, you know, for example, in Tajikistan around whether women should wear headscarves or not, you know, so there are these kind of debates that are going on. You know, young people in particular, I think on the whole, do want to see some form of change. So, yeah, so I think there is some hope there. But ultimately, part of reform will have to come from external actors such as the EU and the OSCE and the United States. And unfortunately, right now, they're not giving the correct incentives to the governments to reform. Ultimately, they're not sending out the right message. They're putting security above political reform, human rights. And, you know, they're giving the message to all of the governments of the region that they can continue, you know, following this kind of downward trajectory. Hmm. And they'll still continue to get military aid and continue to get development money and other sources of rent. So ultimately, I think both, yeah, the external incentives need to change, because internally, amongst young people in particular, there is a desire for change.
Right. Thank you very much, Edward Lemon, for your thoughtful insights. You are the author of the Tajikistan chapter of the report on Nations in Transit. Also, big thanks goes to Nat Schenken, Freedom House's project director of Nations in Transit, and my colleague Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you, gentlemen, for being part of the Majlis today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.